all part of what we call our music heritage. But of course, it's not the limit of what we know as South African music. There's currently a fascinating podcast series. It's called the Gallo Vault Sessions. And they've been unpacking, the people at Gallo, South Africa's oldest record label, have been going into their vaults and going through the almost 100-year history of South African music. Former managing director at Gallo is now the CEO of Content Connect Africa. Antos Stella joins us now on the line to talk about the history of South African music, but through this gaze, through this prism of South Africa's oldest record label, Gallo Music. Antos, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. We're under a lot of pressure to cover the length and breadth of South African music in about 45 minutes. We're not going to get to it, but let's start. What is the story of Gallo Music Records in South Africa?
Thank you so much for having me, Lester. Thank you. I love it when there's a focus on South African music. I've been in the business for so long supporting South African music and now African music. But I always say, well, we know that Gallo was the oldest, is the oldest label on the continent. I think it's celebrating 95 years this year. Can't say that I'm that old, but I joined in the 80s. But I mean, I think that the story is that Eric Gallo, who was the founding member of Gallo, started what was called Brunswick House in 1936. And I do recall, I mean, having been at Gallo for 20 years doing this history a few times over as we celebrated anniversaries, that the story goes that he was, I mean, an Italian immigrant who came to South Africa, and he started importing, not sure it would be vinyls and shellac discs of international artists. He started Brunswick House, which was a little retail outlet. And Gallo grew into, and eventually grew. I think that Gallo was one of the first record labels on the continent that started signing artists, not necessarily to the best deals at the time. But and I think for as far as, you know, I was looking at it and I was thinking about it. And thank you, because it always makes me go back into the history. I mean, one of the oldest songs, but it wasn't through Gallo, was Da Kom Di Alibama. I think if we remember, it was one of the first songs that was recorded in South Africa. Mm. Gallo wasn't, if I remember, there was a shellac disc on that on that song. But my memory of, you know, Gallo in terms of the history was Mbube, which also is obviously has a lot of controversy around it.
Yeah.
But the original Solomon Linda track was a Gallo recording.
Solomon Linda and the original Evening Birds. Let's play a little bit of that again.
Okay.
Connie, let's get, and of course people will, if they know the story of Solomon Linda, they know how the story morphed into what is called Wimowe, what is called When the lion Sleeps Tonight. Just have a listen. Wimowe. Just going through some of the history of Gallo and their first recordings. A lot of the first recorded music in South Africa, particularly in Johannesburg, starting in the mines, starting in the hostels, starting with these groups like Solomon Linda and the original Evening Birds, using traditional rhythms, but then mixed with American influences, creating a very unique, you know, sound that reflects the minerals boom and the founding of the city of Johannesburg, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Right. I suppose, and then, you know, we moved 100%. There was so much influence, but also so much authenticity of the music. And, you know, we morphed into Mbube, moving into Marabi, and then the 40s and the 50s with the Manhattan Brothers, and the various influences. I mean, and I think that we all have to remember that the biggest I always use the song with Ray Perry's words for me, is that we were all tributaries of the great river of pain. But the music always had this influence. So when we moved into the 40s and the 50s, we started seeing the Manhattan Brothers. The one thing that completely, you know, I mean, certainly, and we can talk about the 80s, that absolutely made me so passionate about the music is that South Africans were so resilient, irrespective of the conditions that we were living in. Music filled people's souls, whether it was protest music or jive, jazz, marabi. There was a lot of pain. The music was very upbeat. And I'm sure that I'm not sure, you know, if you recall the Manhattan Brothers, through the 40s and the 50s. I mean, I came into being and understanding. I mean, some of the biggest impacts for me, obviously, was getting into the 70s. And then we had the biggest influence of, you know, disco in the 70s and South African music. I'm not sure if you want to go back to the 40s and the 50s.
We're going to unpack all of that. And when we talk about the Manhattan Brothers, it was a shift in which it was very American influence, but the flavor was of particularly male bands. But then we had the introduction of a very young Miriam Makeba, Tandi Klaassen. And then the band shifted from Dorothy Masuka. Then the band shifted from male groups to the darlings of the Songbirds that even appeared on the covers of Dram magazine back in that time.
I know, right? I was just looking at the Drum magazine. I was looking at a catalog of Drum magazine covers, and you know, I kind of like just have to relate. I mean, it was heartbreaking for me to listen to the news at the top of the hour and all this gender-based violence. And we through the years have had so many strong women in music, and I sometimes think like what my mum Miriam would feel, you know, hearing these stories. Thankfully we still have some very strong women in the industry, but so going back to this, now we had the advent of the female vocalist, the female groups, still very dominated by male producers, I'll have you know, but they came onto the stage and held their own, and so as you say, we became Miriam Makeba and the Skylarks and the 40s and 50s were upon us, you know. I think that you know, then of course, as you say, the birth of Miriam and Dorothy Masuka and Tandi Klaassen, and let's not forget, you know, as we're moving into this now, we're getting into the 60s, and it was one of the reasons we cannot talk about the history of music without talking about the importance of the women in the industry. Yeah. We had Letta and Kaifas, massive impact on the business, but you know, Miriam and the Skylarks, that really was for me the beginning outside of Mbube, which Mbube, as you mentioned, became Wimaware, the Lion Steeps, and all the controversial up to this date. I guess this, moving back to it, is why I had so much I want to learn in the Gallo fold as I entered my 20s, because I understood that, again, whilst the contracts were not great, in fact the contracts were terrible, for the artist, there was an effort to sign artists, and then Mbube just became, it was heartbreaking to see what happened, right?
The story, the lion sleeps tonight, that's the based on the story that Rian Milan wrote on the life of Solomon Linda, and how Mbube somehow, through the process of how record companies work, finds itself in the US, and Pete Seeger hears it, and they then convert this into this folk tune, which later then goes to Wimaware, which later then turns to The Lion Sleeps Tonight, which ends up making the Disney company very, very, very rich. All based on a sound that started essentially in the dormitories and the hostels of Johannesburg during the minerals boom.
100%. And you know, I'm so glad that story was told, but there are many stories to be told.
Can I just let you in on another story of unintended consequences of South African music? Not too long ago, I spoke to the songwriter William Salter, and William Salter is famous for his two Grammys. It's Just the Two of Us, the Grover Washington Jr. song.
And I
spoke to him, and I knew there was a Miriam Makeba connection. And he says that when he was a teenager, Miriam Makeba had just arrived in New York. She had already befriended Harry Belafonte, and Harry Belafonte was looking for session musicians. And William Salter, who was a bassist, answered this ad. He then met Harry Belafonte. Miriam loved him, hired him that day. He went to his current job. He resigned immediately. But it was through his conversation with Miriam Makeba that she says, well, you write beautiful songs. And Miriam Makeba sang his song, When I'm Gone, her famous When I'm Gone. And William Salter says, if it wasn't for Miriam Makeba to arrive in New York, to say yes to this bassist in her session band, he'd never be a songwriter. He'd never write Just the Two of Us. He'd never win two Grammys. I think he won the other Grammy, you know, for a song he wrote for Roberta Flack.
That's an incredible, I didn't know that story. That's an incredible story and an incredible opportunity to to actually speak to William. And as you know, I mean, Gallo's doing podcasts. We're also doing podcasts because our biggest concern all this time is that there's so many people that have histories. We haven't been very good as South Africans, and particularly, I mean, again, let me just say maybe outside of Gallo, we haven't been very good in terms of really archiving our legacy and people telling the stories. It almost got too late for a lot, you know, I mean, passed with Bra Hugh passing and Miriam Makeba passing and, you know, Maklatini passing. There haven't been a lot of stories. And for me, what really breaks my heart is that, you know, kind of when I joined Gallo, the Kwela penny whistle sound was just going out of fashion. But I was very honored to have met some of the great, you know, big voice, Jack Laroli, Weston Causey, who were, you know, before they passed. And there's an entire era that we haven't really, you know, Gallo is now making, you know, there's a big effort. And I've, in my own personal capacity, but through CCA, have tried to buy a lot of those archives to digitize them, to be able to tell the story. So this William Salter story is an amazing story, because I think we still have so much to tell about Miriam and Rahu.
I'm going to play a bit of the trailer for the podcast series, which I'm absolutely loving. But 021-446-0567, drop me a WhatsApp, 072-567-1567. We're talking to Antos Stella, former managing director of Gallo Music. We're talking about the history of South African music through the prism of Gallo Music South Africa, the continent's oldest record label. What's your thoughts? What's your favorite South African tune? 021-446-0567.
You're with Cape Talk.
You're with Cape Talk.
Like a bing bong ball down a mountain stream, like paper riding in the breeze, like strolling in the dark through streets you know. People can feel free as these people be.
Music musicals also being very part of South Africa's story. That's, of course, Back of the Moon, King Kong. But I know that you also have a great affinity for South Africa's musical culture and how that also frames South Africa's music history, from King Kong to Ipintombi to Sarafina. Very much also adding to this chapter in the history of South African music. Antos?
Yeah, wow, 100%. So I was also, again, I mean, I very much part of, I mean, Gallo, when we moved into, you know, when I joined Gallo early 80s, Sarafina was a big, we launched Sarafina at the Market Theatre. And I know that there was King Kong before, there were so many musicals. And I wonder, maybe just before I get on to Sarafina, just talk about Ipintombi, because it's come up a lot. And I've been thinking so much about Margaret Sangana recently and how, again, it's a legacy that we have not really honored. But Ipintombi really changed my life. And again, there's a massive, only when I got into the industry did I understand how controversial it was at the time. But Margaret Sangana made such a massive impact on me as a youngster, just vocally. And I mean, you know, we know this, and I recently did a quick little profile on Margaret. So Ipintombi was kind of like, I mean, if I can call this, in those days, one would talk about what would cross over to audiences, right? It's a musical term. So all audiences at that stage were going to watch, play musical theater. And I think that musical theater had a great influence on people, artists and music crossing to different audiences and not being caught, relative to one audience. And I'm talking purely from a record label perspective. But coming to Sarafina, well, you know, the great Mbangeni Ngema, and, I do remember launching this at the Market Theatre and having, I think that also again the late Winnie Mandela came to the theatre as our guest, and wow, there was so much controversy around that as well. But Sarafina then went on to be, I think we're talking about the 80s, right? If I'm remembering well, I'm trying to just remember which year in the 80s. Do you know, Lester, what year it was? I'm trying to think of what year it was.
I'm a child of the 80s, so I often can't remember what happens in the
80s. Passing my mind back to exactly what year it was. But anyway, I mean, I do remember it was such a highlight of my career then. You know, when we moved into worked in the 80s, the members, the owners of Gallo at the time were very much shifting into moving not only the industry but working within the politics of South Africa. It was great protest time for the record label as it was at the time.
Antos, Stella is the former managing director of Gallo Music, currently the CEO of Content Connect Africa. We're talking about the history of South African music. So much to talk about. We are talking about the history of South African music through the prism of the Gallo Record Company, about 95 years old, the oldest record company on the African continent. We're speaking to its former managing director, Antos Stello, is part of a documentary podcast series which delves into the history of Gallo Records. They've unlocked their vault, unsealed their vault, and they found there's so many records that just haven't seen the light of day for many, many years. So we thought, let's talk about this very broad history of South African music. What's your favorite South African sound? Whether it be Boere or Kes, whether it be Kwela, whether it be the Kwaito sounds of Trompies, maybe it's young hip-hop in the early 90s like Squatter Camp, maybe it's Judith Sapuma. Let me know, 021-446-0567. Antos, thanks so much for staying on the line with us. There is a quick question from a listener wanting to know the story or the history behind the song Paradise Road by the band Joy.
Oh, gosh, Joy. Oh, my. funny that someone should call in. It was when I was asked what are my, you know, the historical songs, right? Paradise, the group Joy again, has so much history. Paradise Road was written actually by I think it was Patrick van Blerk. And Joy was just the song. Okay. So there are a number of meanings behind the song. And I must be honest with you. The song resonated. Are you there?
I'm listening. I'm listening.
Sorry. I suddenly thought you'd disappear.
No, it's fine. when I'm interested, I keep quiet.
If you remember, I'm just trying to talk about the lyrics now. Come with me down paradise, right? It was actually written by Patrick van Blerk, and it was recorded. I know this was the beginning of the 80s with, yes, I mean, our all female group of Joy. And the song it has a couple of stories, but it really was one of the top hits in the beginning of the 80s. And it was really a kind of like with I'm singing the song in my mind, and there are better days before us,
yeah,
and the burning bridge behind us, fire smoking, the sky is blazing. And there's a woman weeping. I'm trying to remember the song, and a young man nearly beaten. And I think we know that as we moved into the 80s, in the 60s, the brutal repression,
yeah,
of the National Party and apartheid, and we're completely brutal. And we had come through the 60s and the 70s, and the 80s, there was this underlying know that things had to change. And for me, the lyrics of that song was, I mean, you know, paradise is burning. And I think it had been burning for a long time, because let's be honest, as a continent, this is paradise. And I know that, I mean, you know, I don't want to swear on radio, so I must remember to use my words wisely. It was the time when music and the struggle, when I entered the struggle, music was it was eclectic. No matter what genre of music and who was listening to music, there was anger from what had happened in the past, and there was the beginning of the move. So Paradise Road was very much written about, I mean, you know, the country at the time. There are better days before us, and the burning bridge behind us. Fire smoking. I mean, you know, paradise was almost closing down. We were almost closing down. So I can only give you my interpretation of that song, but I do think that, you know, often when I've spoken to Patrick, you know, I mean, hey, I think Felicia, it was just such an incredible, it was just such an incredible time.
It's hard now, in retrospect, not to see the lyrical significance of songs like
all the songs,
like Paradise Road, even Stimela's Unfinished Story.
Whispers in the Dark. I mean,
Lucky Dube's Prisoner, you know, released after the release of Nelson Mandela. We cannot now in 2022 look back and say that those were deliberately political. But let's talk about censorship and banning. Sharpeville Massacre happens, violent repression, banning orders, censorship.
Violent.
How does that era affect the record making industry in South Africa? How do you have a flourishing creative industry when there are censors, you know, checking lyrics and lines, and deciding at the whim of an administrator whether the song is playable or not?
It came very much down. Look, I mean, it was the beginning burning. I was kind of born in the early 60s. So I do remember that radio was completely censored. And even when I joined in the 80s in the music industry, when I joined in the 80s, music was still censored. I mean, I remember Lucky, Bob Marley, you know, a lot of tracks. And you talk about Stimela, you know, I think every one of Stimela and Ray Perry's songs had an underlying. I think about Chico and, you know, I mean, Papa Stop the War and We Miss You Manolo. Going back to Sharpeville, the music still existed, and it was completely protest music, and it was music painful music. And there was such a commitment to buying the music and to listening to the music. You know, and I'm sure that over the years you've heard Miriam speak and you know, Johnny Clegg and everybody, if you speak to Hotline, there was this people really, and the record labels, whilst they were not big, it wasn't the explosion of music industry. The music was still getting to an audience who wanted music as a reprieve, but also as a protest. So I think that at that stage, I kind of wasn't there at the time, that the record, the Gallo, and I'm talking about Gallo specifically, because if I'm not mistaken, Gallo was the only record label that was really significantly involved in recording South African artists.
A song that Gallo brought to South Africa was Donna Summer's Love to Love You Baby, and apparently that was apparently that was banned, you know, because a Christian Calvinist nationalist society, in simply because of what they found was too heavy breathing in Donna Summer's Love to Love You Baby.
100%. But let me tell you, I still managed to get the vinyl. So, I mean, there were outlets that were bringing it in. I mean, I guess that, you know, I could talk about resilience, and that's what it was. But yeah, I mean, oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, you know, for me, the big explosion is, again, when we came to the 80s, where there was punk, there was just all this political underlying pain, reggae, you know, Lucky, all of these artists, that Yvonne, Chico, you know, I mean, the record labels called it bubblegum pop, you know, the Splashes and the Machicos, and, you know, well, let's not forget about, I mean, you know, Vicky Sampson and Hotline and PJ Powers. And
a lot of people referencing Pacific Express here as well. Zayn Adams.
Yes, Pacific Express. Yeah. Oh my gosh. How can we forget Pacific Express?
One of my favorite albums is Black Disco, Night Express. I hope I have time sometime in the show to play that, but it's an absolutely great album. But we're speaking to Antos Stella, former managing director of Gallo Music. We're talking about the history of South African music. We cannot, it's impossible to simply do it in an hour. But that's why I want to direct you to a podcast series in which Gallo history goes into their own vaults. It's called Gallo Vault Sessions. You can download it wherever you download your podcast. Here's a quick trailer and we'll come back to Antos after this.
Gallo Vault Sessions podcast is a 6-part series brought to you by Gallo Music in collaboration with Gonjo.
I was lucky that when I joined Gallo, we were still selling from the archives.
At that time, we had a promo vehicle with big speakers on, and we used to blast it the whole time, and we had little tickets that we used to give out. And eventually, those people used to go into the stores, into Marabastat, and purchase the stuff directly.
Everything that people know globally about South African music, most of it comes out of Gallo.
These are all over 100,000 sellers.
Gallo Vault Sessions. In this podcast, we delve into the story of Gallo, Africa's largest and oldest recording company, and reflect on the ways music shapes culture and how culture has been shaped by music, both at the center and periphery of Africa's music history.
Black composers were not getting composers' royalties.
The record companies recorded Afrikaans music and they recorded African music.
Can you imagine?
We bridge 95 years of Gallo's music history with Gonjo's passion for cultural storytelling and chat with artists, label execs, radio veterans, and music thinkers as we explore the undercurrents, backstories, and overlooked tapes from the Gallo vault.
My name is Sipho Hartstix Mabuse.
South African artists are so well known in the rest of Africa.
From Mbaqanga to Soul.
The Hararis, the Umojas, the Steve Kakanas.
And of course, provide you with a curated playlist to soundtrack your month.
Antos, I hear your voice in that podcast trailer. What's it like, you know, just being recounting and being part of this project to look into the history of not only Gallo but South Africa's music scene. I'm really, really enjoying this podcast series.
So let me tell you a very, very quick, strange story about my life at Gallo. And I was with Gallo from 1984 to 2004. It really is the soundtrack to my life. It continued to be the soundtrack to my life. I was so honored. I don't know if you remember in the 80s, we used to hold 6 to 6 concerts. Yeah. Where we would go from 6 o'clock in the evening to 6 o'clock in the morning. I would travel into Attridgeville and I'm into Tokoza. We used to have, from Brenda Fassie to Stimela to Lucky, performing at all of these shows. In 2004, I made a decision to leave Gallo because I really wanted to explore more music from the continent. And also I could see the digital explosion was coming. So I really wanted to do, and I felt like the music industry was getting too corporate. And I felt like it was time to level the playing fields for artists. So I started my own business and I landed up, doing a management buyout with a company called Content Connect Africa. And recently Gallo bought 45% of Content Connect Africa. And so we're here to discover. I think that my objective is to really start honoring and talking about the legends of South African music. So this vault, Miss Gallo Vault Sessions has been such a pleasure to listen to. And it's taken me on a journey. It's taken me personally on an incredible journey. As I say, from the 70s moving onwards, to I'm a Piano, which my young team now are, they sit in the talk about I'm a Piano. I'm going, okay.
We spoke to DJ Christos. We spoke to DJ Christos yesterday just to look at what influence and what impact TKZ and Tokolo Shabalala had on mainstreaming of Kwaito. That is all part of the story from DJ Christos and Koskido to TKZ to House Music, Fresh House Flavor, one of my favorite series, to Kom, to Amapiano. It starts somewhere and maybe even it starts with Solomon Linda and Rube. But let's go to the phone lines now. Craig and Tukai, good morning. Thanks so much for your patience. Bernie, I also see you. Good morning, Craig.
Hi, listen. I just picked up part of the conversation about the apartheid era censorship. And I just wanted to mention the incredible story about, for those who don't know, about Chiluka's first hit song on their first album, Ubula Bumbelo. Was a Friday, and they got into trouble with the censors here for mixing English and Zulu lyrics, and it was banned banned on the airwaves, and apparently played in the homelands and topped the charts.
Gosh, but that's also part. Thanks so much, Craig. That's also part of the apartheid project with regional tribalist-based radio stations, which are part of segmenting and dividing different groups, but there's a thread in there that says, well, that actually also maybe developed South African music in which, because these radio stations needed content, for example, Radio Zulu could only play Zulu music, and so therefore there's a story of actively going out to seek Zulu language performers.
Bernie, 100%.
Bernie in Kenilworth, good morning.
Wow, thank you for taking my call, Lester. What an interesting program. Thank you, and to your guests. I'd just like to make a mention to the group Sons of Selassie. They've been going since 1985 in the peak of the apartheid era and released an album, a debut album in 1992 called Changes, which went worldwide. So it was released internationally and not really locally, but they are still performing live everywhere. The singer Brahma, he's still, going. He's opened a school for the youth. And please just link up with the group Sons of Selassie. They were releasing and performing at places like the Base and the big festivals at UWC and UCT and the Cape Technicon. So, it's a group that needs to be mentioned. Thank you so much, Lester.
Really appreciating you taking us on a thread now, on a route to reggae and the late, great Lucky Dube. You represent South African reggae music. Tell us about your interactions with the now late great Lucky Dube.
Wow. Well, I mean, yeah, I was, you know, Lucky, I traveled the world with Lucky, and I watched him break into being the all over the world, being one of the biggest and still the biggest selling artist in Africa. And, you know, Lucky, it's interesting that you played Slave because, I mean, the Slave, if you listen to the lyrics as well, he talks about I'm a liquor slave. And Lucky, I don't know if anybody knows this, was really adverse to alcohol. I mean, he didn't, you know, smoke weed. He wasn't a, you know, a rasta as people would stereotype it. Lucky's story was very tragic growing up as well. But I think that Slave also had this connotation. It did get banned, but he was, you know, trying to use the liquor slave as opposed to the word slave in its true meaning. But let's talk about, I mean, you know, Lucky's lyrics and Lucky's music was had a massive impact on our continent. And I want to talk about that first because I was privileged enough to travel with him across the continent. And that's what made me began my journey on how amazing, what amazing music there is from the continent, but how the rest of Africa had really, and I shouldn't say the rest of Africa, but outside of South Africa had embraced our music, but we had never really quite, and I think it's because of apartheid, not think it definitely did not really kind of play the music on music from Nigeria, and a completely different story now. I'm talking, you know, in the 80s and 90s, but Lucky, I told you that there's a song called Remember Me that Lucky did in 1989. And when I traveled with Lucky into Uganda, Rwanda, Ghana, Nigeria, there's some incredible stories about Lucky, how a Red Cross, official was crossing from Liberia and was literally arrested, and he was able to get through the border by giving the soldier a Lucky Dube tape. But Remember Me is a song that every time Lucky got onto stage and he would begin the song, that he couldn't sing the song because 70,000 strong audience would sing the song for him. And if you again talk about the lyrics, it's like wandering down the streets of Soweto, it's like, Daddy, wherever you are, remember me. But Lucky, you know, for me again, is a legacy that we not uphold as South Africans. He won so many awards internationally, and like Ladysmith Black Mambazo, landed up having a career more global career than a local career. Ladysmith Black Mambazo also, you know, 5 Grammy Awards. But Lucky and I developed a really, really close relationship and became almost like brother and sister. And he was one of the first artists that really, you know, spoke about the experiences and the pain and how things needed to change. But also had a lot of songs that he had to, he was banned for a very long time. And only when we came out of into the early 90s where he had the freedom to sing. He originally didn't do reggae. In fact, Gallo Record Company didn't want him to change from the conga to reggae. He did it secretively with Rastas Never Die. I could sit and talk to you about, the 80s and Lucky and Makhlatini and the Mawatila Queens and Chico and all of them for hours. But Lucky, we should remember him. You know, I was with him when he did his first performance in Jamaica. At that time in Jamaica, when we went in, they kept our passports. They wouldn't allow us to go into Jamaica carrying our passports because of apartheid. And Lucky had 6 encores.
Oh, gosh.
So his debut in Jamaica, he had 6 encores. We could not get him. Like, people just would not allow him to get off stage. So, He's he was and is a legend of South African music.
And there's a reason I want to end with this song for our musical journey. I'm going to be over time, but I'm sure Graham Robe and I of Eyewitness News will indulge me. It's this song.
Revolutionaries die, and the children forget. The ghetto is our first love, and our dreams are drenched in gold.
Tandiswa Mzwai there, Antos. And yesterday in reflecting on Tokolo, I said that the 1999 to 2009 was a really hopeful time for me as a young South African. The late 90s where I'm figuring out my space in South Africa, mm-hmm. meeting a heck of a lot new people. I'm watching Pure Manati show on a Friday night, and I'm going to House Jewels, and we going to TKZ concerts and Bongo Muffin concerts on Saturdays. That is where I find myself and place in South Africa. So that Tandiswa Mzwai for me represents a changing in South Africa, particularly youth culture and how we find our space.
100 and Santu Gallo as well. I worked with Tandiswa on Zabalaza, the album. You're right. That was just another amazing time for South African music. TKZ, wow. You know, Tokolo was an unbelievable, also just an amazing. I was also honored to have worked with the guys, but Tokolo most recently, having lots of conversations about a couple of years ago. Boomshaka, Lebo Mathosa. Again, another icon for South African music, gone too soon. Boomshaka, we could talk for hours, but yeah, it's another whole generation of music, and there's a story behind every song.
And that's why I want to direct people to go and go listen to those vault sessions, those Gallo vault sessions, and wherever you download your podcast. Antos Stella, former managing director of Gallo.